Okay, so I wrote a list of my collaborators here on the topics that we've been talking about. And I should say that I've mostly been talking about gauge theory, abelian gauge theory, and talk a little bit about the non-abelian case. But most of what I'm saying is there are in this subject new results, but most of what I've been saying in this lecture is new words on old results. Certainly, QED is the most studied theory and well-tested theory in the history of human thought, and there isn't some calculation that I'm doing that nobody knew how to do before. But I do think that we have a new way of formulating it and thinking about it in terms of symmetries. And this new way of thinking about thing already has gone on and generated new results in nearby areas. And some of those I'll talk about at my talk at the workshop. Okay, so at the end of last episode, we had a formula which was 4 pi times. So what I am going to do now is explain what all this has to do with the soft theorem. And so we had a formula which is 4 pi times any outgoing state times dzn, the derivative of the soft photon zero mode, S, where that's the S matrix, minus S dzn minus any instate is equal to the sum over k, qk over z minus zk, the sum over all outgoing particles, where, so we have a particle outgoing on the celestial sphere, which comes out at zk with charge qk, the red sphere over there, and minus the sum over k in, qk over z minus the antipodally related point on the incoming sphere, out s in. So this is a formula which you take any S matrix element, you multiply it by a number which depends on Z. So you pick a point on the sphere, you multiply it by a number which depends on that point of the sphere, and then you relate that to the same S matrix element with the insertion of a soft photon at the point that you picked. Now, this sounds an awful lot like the soft photon theorem, and indeed, it is exactly the soft photon theorem, though since it's written in such different kind of coordinate system, it's somewhat tedious to show that it's the same thing. But let me sketch how the derivation goes. So we have a field. Now, X is a standard Cartesian coordinate on Minkowski space, not advanced or retarded. So we would write an expansion for the field as the sum over polarizations, alpha equals plus or minus, integral d cubed q, this is the operator, over 2 pi cubed, to omega times, so we pick some polarization vectors, epsilon star, so sum over polarizations plus or minus, epsilon star alpha plus or minus nu, of Q, three vector Q, A alpha, say we're looking at the outgoing guy, A alpha out of Q, E to the I Q dot X, plus the Hermitian conjugate, which involves the opposite polarization, and this is annihilation operator, there's creation operator here. Okay, and then we have standard commutation relations that A alpha out of Q, A beta out dagger of Q prime is equal to delta alpha beta 2 pi cubed. There's a 2 omega in the conventional, in this normalization, times delta cubed Q minus Q prime. Okay. Now, this DZN is constructed from AZ, it's a zero mode of AZ zero, which depends on U, Z, and Z bar. But that is defined as the limit as R goes to infinity of AZ mu in these retarded coordinates of U, R, Z, Z bar. Now, in general, I might need some power of R here, depending on what I was doing, but in this particular case, the leading term in the transverse photon field is of order R to the zero. So, we can take this formula, we can do the coordinate transformation, and then we can take the limit, and we can ask, what do you get if you do that? And you want to employ a stationary phase approximation at large R to get a simplified form for the answer. And so let me write down the answer. Can everybody see the bottom of the blackboard? Yeah, it's a well-designed auditorium. Okay. So it's equal to minus I over 8 pi squared. Square root of 2e over 1 plus zz bar. And then here's the interesting part. Integral from 0 to infinity d omega of A plus positive polarization out omega x hat. What is x hat? Well, x hat is the unit vector that points towards z. So x hat is equal to 1 over 1 plus zz bar, z plus z bar, I z minus z bar, and 1 minus zz bar. So x hat is the unit vector that points towards v in this, point z in the sphere. E to the minus I omega u minus A minus out dagger also of omega x hat E to the I omega u, close bracket. So, okay, so up to the factors, there's something obvious about this formula, and that is that if you take the field operator and you push it up to a point at null infinity, it creates and annihilates photons with, so we take the field operator, we push it up to there, it creates and annihilates photons that are headed to that direction. That's what this formula is saying. And also, we see this is an AZ. Now, if we do a rotation around Z, it gets a definite phase. So it's a helicity eigenstate. So this thing annihilates positive helicity photons and creates negative helicity photons. If I take an AZ bar, I'd have had minuses and pluses. Okay, so now what I have to do is I have to take this, integrate over U. N dzn, e squared dzn, was equal to minus infinity to infinity du fuz. So this, the fact that we're integrating f, so I want to get this n out of the a. I've got a du az here, so I have to multiply by an omega. So I can now construct the zero frequency mode of this thing, and I learn that this dzn is equal to e squared, with the e squared there, I guess, some factors times omega, the limit as omega goes to zero, omega a plus positive helicity guy of omega x hat plus omega a minus dagger of omega x hat. Now, you might say, whoa, wait a second, I'm taking the limit of omega to zero, I'm multiplying by omega, why isn't this trivial? Well, this is not trivial because of the famous pole in scattering amplitudes with saw photons. So that explicit omega is going to end up canceling the pole. Okay, so finally, so this is what this NZ is. I'm adding an incoming and an outcoming so I'm really taking the difference of two soft theorems, where one where I have an incoming photon and one where I have an outgoing photon. But so at the end of the day, when I work this all out, this is equal to the limit. Really, I get two terms, one from here and one from here, but they're equal. Limit omega goes to zero of omega out a plus out of q s n is equal to. Okay, so now I have to rewrite all this, and again, I can relate z to the q of the soft photon, and zk to the pk of the charged particles. And so at the end of the day, I get that this is equal to E times the limit as omega goes to zero of the sum over outgoing particles, QK, and that whole factor there becomes PK dot the polarization over Q dot pk, and there's an explicit omega here, and this is the polarization of the photon, minus the same thing, the ingoing vectors. So this is, indeed is the standard formulation. Well, the standard formalization of the soft theorem, you have a pole. We got rid of the pole by simply multiplying by omega and taking omega to zero. That's how we had a finite result. So this reduces then to the standard form of the soft photon theorem. Yes?
So all the non-soft contributions cancel in the commutator?
Right. Well, the non-soft contributions cancel because often the soft theorem is written as the quality of two things, and there's a leading pole on both sides, which has a universal relationship. What I'm doing is I'm multiplying by the energy, omega. I'm doing something trivial. I'm just projecting out the pole. So anything that is subleading in omega is going to just be trivially canceled by this. Right. Anything without a pole just trivially cancels. But even before that, see, this is a general formula between fields on scribe plus. It's not restricted to soft fields. Between fields on scribe plus and the standard plane wave annihilation and creation operators. And I needed to take the zero mode of that, right? So I'm going to integrate over U, which will project me to omega equals zero. Zero modes are tricky, so I keep omega a little away from zero and take the limit. That's why I bothered writing all that limit stuff. Okay, now, of course, the argument can be run the other way around. We could just start with this soft theorem, and in various instances, the arguments has been run away around. For example, run the other way around. For example, with Dumitrescu, whose name I didn't write up there, because I didn't think I was going to mention it, but there's a soft Fotino theorem. And so you could start with this. You could rewrite it as, any linear relation among S matrix elements, certainly if it can be written as a commutator, can be understood as some kind of symmetry. And so you could start from this. It would be rather hard to guess, but you could rewrite this as the statement that the S matrix has a symmetry and that there are some conservation laws. They're completely equivalent statements. Now, there's a very funny thing that happens. However, here, you can see already from here. So let's think of linear relationships among S matrix elements as symmetries. But we seem to have one symmetry for every kind of soft photon. And there are two, so that gives you a direction on the sphere, right? So you can let the soft photon momentum approach zero from any direction on the sphere. And that's why there's a whole sphere's worth. That's why, from this point of view, why there's an infinite number of symmetries. There's also a factor of two which caused a lot of consternation in the beginning, which is you might think you had two spheres' worth of symmetries because you can take either polarization of soft photon and take it to zero. But in fact, there is, that would have made no sense because from the other way we wrote it, there was only one Goldstone boson, not two of them. And the answer is that there's a bizarre linear combination of, if there are no magnetic charges, there is a bizarre linear combination of the soft photon, of a soft, there's an insertion of a soft photon. And for those of you who know about 2D conformal field theory, the soft photon, positively polarized soft photon, and the shadow transform of the negatively polarized photon, which decouples from every matrix element and is completely trivial. So the positive helicity and the negative helicity soft photon theorems are not linearly independent, and there's only one soft photon theorem. One degree of one symmetry per point on the sphere. Right, so I was saying, so for example, however, if you add magnetic charges, there's some other terms in here, and then it's no longer true that the two polarizations are linearly related to each other. There's a second set of soft theorems, and there's a second set of gauge symmetries, and a second set of Goldstone bosons, which we can understand as actually a complexification of the electric Goldstone boson. But that's yet another story. Okay, so with Dumitrescu, just to give an example of how this sort of leads to new things, there's a soft Fotino theorem. And what seems puzzling at first about the soft Fotino theorem, and this is a puzzle which I think it gets even more involved in the n equals 4 context. See, with the soft photon theorem, you could guess that they were related to large gauge symmetries of some kind. But what about the soft Fotino theorem? N equals 1 supersymmetric spheres don't have infinite numbers of fermionic gauge symmetries. They have only four, the four supercharges. And so the only way that we knew of to understand these was to, you know, work backwards from the soft Fotino theorem, push it the other way. And we found that, in fact, there is a rather peculiar infinite set of symmetries, of fermionic symmetries, of every theory, every abelian gauge theory with the soft, every abelian gauge theory which has a massless Fotino. Okay, so that's what I'm going to say about the soft theorem. I'm going to say just a few words about non-abelian gauge theory. But let me pause there for questions.
So yes. This sentence that each of these conserving charges kind of a one soft photon. So is there a way how you can understand the infinite number as being infinite number of soft photons? Is it like one by one, or there is no sense? If there is some reasonable restriction to 10 soft photons, for example.
To what?
Well, to some finite number of soft photons. Can you construct a finite number of conserved charges?
At the classical level, the degenerate vacua are described by flat connections on the sphere. And the soft photons are really very explicitly edge modes, right? If you write this integral there, it's a boundary term with a boundary here and a boundary there. So the soft photons are edge modes that live at the boundary of null infinity. So they also live on a sphere. They don't live on R3. They're edge modes at infinity. And so when you add or subtract soft photons, you're playing with the boundary. Now, in the classical story, as I just said, we can think of the vacua, naturally think of the vacua as parameterized by flat connections on the sphere. In the quantum story, we can think of it as changing the vacua by adding or subtracting soft photons, but the, you know, a classical flat connection is some kind of coherent state of soft photons. So in any real scattering process, we actually change the flat connection. And so we will be adding or subtracting infinite numbers of soft photons. Did that answer your question? Okay. So what about non-abelian gauge theory? So in non-abelian gauge theory, in standard textbook discussions, my claim is that a very, you know, very near analog of this same discussion leads to the conclusion that in non-abelian gauge theory, the vacua are also classically characterized by a flat connection on the sphere. And at the quantum level, we can think of these as adding or subtracting soft gluons. But I should hasten to add that that in the non-abelian theory, the abelian soft photon theorem is exact. But in the non-abelian theory, we have to think about loop corrections to the soft theorem, and we have some idea of what those mean, but not a complete understanding. But when you have some process where, what do I mean? We always assume that there's a connection on the sphere, the celestial sphere, which is, and this is now a non-abelian A, which is trivial. What do I mean by that? So suppose we have some completely neutral object which decays to two gluons, one of which goes to the North Pole and one of which goes to the South Pole. So we'd usually say, okay, we started out with something with no color. We create a gluon and an anti-gluon with opposite color. The initial state and the final state is in a color singlet. Well, in order to say it's a color singlet, it's completely meaningless to say that two things which are separated are in a color singlet. We need a rule to parallel transport it from the South Pole to the North Pole, and then we can see if the two things are pointing in the same direction in color space. And so in textbook treatments, we assume that there's a flat color frame at infinity, and so we can compare it and we can say that this is a color singlet. Now, this is a, but this is a funny thing to do because we can see by basically the same argument I gave before that whenever you have color flux through infinity, if you start with a flat connection AZ equals zero and you send gluons through infinity, so if we start with AZ, non-abelian AZ, let me put an index on there, and we send gluons out like this, then we'll have, if it's zero here, even classically, AZ will not be zero up there. So in general, we need to talk about a color frame, a non-trivial color frame at infinity, and again, there's an infinity of degenerate vacua. Now, I just wanted to say a word about how this is related to a G. Katz-Moody algebra. So, so let's define JZ as equal to minus 4 pi over G squared Yang-Mills times NZ. So this has an index on it. NZ minus NZ minus, also with an A index, where these are just, again, the zero modes of the gluon integrated over scri plus or scri minus. Now I want to write a scattering amplitude in this way. I want to just write it, instead of writing it out and in, I want to just write it in a different notation where I have some operator O, which creates some incoming particle, which comes in at Z1, Z bar 1, O2, so on. And these can be in different representations of the gauge group. I'm suppressing the representation index O2 of Z2, Z bar 2, dot, dot, dot. So I can write a scattering amplitude, an endpoint scattering amplitude, just write it in this form, where I'm suppressing other quantum numbers, energies, or whatever that are associated with these operators that create these states. Now, I'm going to insert this thing. And inserting this thing means I take whatever S matrix element this is, and I add a soft gluon to the outgoing state multiplied by omega and similarly to the ingoing state. So I put an insertion of JZ. Okay. And now, in this language, I can rewrite the soft gluon theorem as the sum over 1 over z minus zk of O1, Z1, Z bar 1, dot, 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 sum over k. And now what I get, instead of qk, as I get in the Beelin case, I get an insertion sum over, I assume that the kth operator is in the representation TAK. This is the generator in that representation, ON, ZN, Z bar N. Okay, so this is the leading soft gluon theorem. Okay, so this should be recognized as the Ward identity for a two-dimensional CFT in which the soft photon insertion plays the two-dimensional CFT, the Ward identity for a current algebra with gauge group G, where the Katz-Moody current, the G Katz-Moody current, is realized by an insertion of a soft gluon. And this also can be understood to follow. Again, this is equivalent to the statement that Q plus epsilon, which is equal to the integral scri plus minus of Q trace epsilon, where this is valued in the gauge group, star f is equal to q minus epsilon, which is equal to the same thing evaluated at scribe minus plus of trace epsilon star f. Okay, so this has not been explored very much beyond this original observation, but I'm mentioning it because people in the room are interested in scattering in non-abelian gauge theory. Yes?
So can you say if this perspective tells you something interesting about the exponentiation of this self-clearance? Because in non-abelian gauge theory, this is quite non-trivial, how to exponentiate this and make it into a full... And this, for the self-clearance theorem, wasn't this a long time ago, but for non-abelian gauge theory, it's pretty recent.
I don't think anybody has discussed that. Now, one way of, but I would think that this might well be helpful for understanding that. I mean, we do discuss a little bit about, going back to what I said a few minutes ago, if you like, these are matrix elements which are evaluated in the conventional way, assuming that there's a flat connection on the sphere at infinity. And another way of understanding what this formula means is that it tells you the relationship between this, if you like, generates, it's the generator of new flat connections on the sphere at infinity. So yes, I think that thinking about it in terms of flat connections at the sphere at infinity may well be helpful, and may also be relevant for understanding the problem of infrared divergences, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. But yes, that is exactly the kind of thing that I would hope that this would be useful for. Okay. So all right, so I guess I'm going to go from there to talk about now about infrared divergences. And I should say this is very recent work, and we haven't even really finished the calculation, let alone write up the paper. But it's always more fun to talk about recent things and to hopefully get some feedback. Now, somehow we are looking and describing the infrared sector of gauge theory in a new way and organizing it with a symmetry principle. And of course, there is one big thing that you would like to understand about the infrared sector of gauge theory, and that is, you know, in some sense, well, the S matrix supposedly doesn't exist because of infrared divergences. What does that mean? What we've been studying, you know, especially in the non-abelian case, what are we supposed to do about this? You know, how can we be spending so much time studying something which doesn't exist? And will these new insights tell us anything useful? So, and what is the relationship? So, let's do the following. So I have these two operators, nz and n minus z, which are zero modes of the incoming and outgoing photons. And let's consider scattering in, we have to say something about what our incoming and outgoing vacua are. So let's consider scattering in a basis of states, which are eigenstates of the these operators. This isn't usually what you would do. The usual states would be eigenstates of the soft photon creation or annihilation operators, but I can go back to that basis as a sort of it's a kind of Gaussian wave packet of these eigenstates. But it's simpler to think about the structure in terms of these guys. So I take somebody with an eigenstate n in z in n in z, where in here denotes any kind of hard electron, positron, any kind of charged particle. Well, I'm really only talking about massless charged particles now. But the massive would not change it much, and also could be various hard photons. And similarly for outstates, I would have nz out nz is equal to nz out. So we have these eigenstates.
In defining the in states, they can be arbitrarily low momentum.
So the Hilbert space, no, I don't have a cutoff. So they can be arbitrarily low. Well, I'm explicitly writing what I'm doing with the zero mode sector. So when we wrote down the symplectic form that we were quantizing, modes of non-zero omega are paired symplectically positive and negative, right? Which the zero mode is just one. And so where that has to have a partner, and its partner is the Goldstone boson. So I'm these are out or in, those are the any photons not at zero momentum, but arbitrarily small. Okay, so now we write out nz out our Ward identity, which was here and I erased, nz times the S matrix minus S nz minus in. The Ward identity was true for any state, so in particular it's true for these states. Nz in, and that's equal to the soft factor omega z out nz out s in nz in, where omega z is the soft factor 1 over 4 pi sum of qk over z minus zk minus n. Okay, and out. So that's just the soft factor, just a number. Okay, but now I've chosen these things to be eigenstates. So I learn that nz out minus nz in out blah, 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 s blah, 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 n is equal to omega z blah, 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 s blah, blah, blah. These are the same matrix elements. Okay? So, there are two possibilities here. The two possibilities are that out, well, let me write the simplest, what would seem to be the simplest one first. Nz out minus Nz in is equal to omega z. Or, also consistent, is out Nz out s in Nz in is equal to zero. Those are the two possibilities. Now, in fact, this is the one that is chosen in quantum field theory textbooks. Right? In quantum field theory textbooks, all S matrix elements are zero because of infrared divergences. In standard quantum field theory textbooks, they don't put in the possibility of having the outgoing vacuum being different from the ingoing vacuum. And the rules of quantum field theory are smart enough not to create an inconsistency. And so they just say, okay, yes, okay, you're free to choose the outgoing vacuum to be the same as the ingoing vacuum, but the amplitude of that for zero. And the way that that quantum field theory gets to zero is by summation of infrared divergences, which set all S matrix elements to zero. But it seems like a nicer thing to do would be to, instead of insisting on computing, so classically, we looked at the classical story. If you solve the classical equations, you always get this. That's what I was arguing before. The final flat connection, these are differences in connections at the boundary of scry, and you will always get a shift in the flat connection in any non-trivial scattering process. The only way you don't get a shift in the flat connection is if the soft factor is zero, which means that the outgoing particles are all exactly, they did forward scattering, they just went through no interactions, and they came out at the same, with antipodal locations to where they went in. And how does quantum field theory give zero for this? Well, basically, you have some ingoing particles, some outgoing particles. There's exchanges between photons between external legs. You exponentiate those, and due to a divergence at zero momentum, that gets set to zero. Now, this selection rule really came, all we did was to integrate the constraints. So at infinity, and that led us to this conclusion. So that suggests that we should think about how we're dealing with the constraint equations and the fact that charges necessarily source electromagnetic fields. So my claim is going to be, in a little bit, that in fact, if we allow for these different vacua, that we can get S-matrix elements which are completely IR finite in QED. Okay, so let's now talk about the constraints. So the constraints on scry minus take the form dvfrv2 minus dzf0vz minus dz bar f0vz bar. Actually, I might have a sign problem here, but it won't matter. Plus e squared jv is equal to 0. So we can't just have an incoming charge without somehow exciting the electromagnetic field. Now, just to be completely explicit, let's just consider a particle of charge q, which comes in at advanced time v0, and at a point z0 on the sphere. You know, we could have multiple charges, but this will be enough to illustrate what's going on. Now, this is more constraints. This is more, sorry, let me back up a second. So the point of view, we haven't gone quantum yet, but we're about to. And there are many different formalisms for quantizing this, but there's one that is, I think, is particularly natural on Scry Plus that most people would use. So these J's are, you know, electrons or whatever. It's quadratic. It'll be bilinear in the electron field. Some standard creation annihilation operators. And then FVZ and FVZ bar are constructed from AZ bar, which is the radiative degree of freedom of the electromagnetic field. And I gave an explicit expression a little bit earlier, which maybe I will write down again because it I'll be needing it, which is AZ of UZ Z bar F the W bar of U prime W W bar is equal up to a sign I e squared over 2 delta U minus U prime delta squared Z minus W. So F is also constructed just the V derivative of A. So this is an exact commutator. But what about FRV? Well, FRV is whatever it needs to be in order that this equation is always satisfied. In other words, if we want to compute commutators with FRV, we need to rewrite them, FRV, re-express it. It's a constrained field. We need to re-express it in terms of these guys, and then compute their commutators using this formula and whatever the thing is for the electron form. That is just what Dirac told us to do in the, whatever, 40s or 50s. That is a simple way in this context of implementing the Dirac procedure. Okay, but still, going back to the classical story here, there are two ways that we could solve this constraint equations. Well, there's infinitely many ways, but because we can always add a homogeneous solution of this equation. But the two main ways are we could take FRV2 equals Q0 theta V minus V0 delta squared z minus z0. I guess we need a minus e squared there. And if we take the derivative of f, we get this, and we can leave those terms alone. That is saying that we're going to have this charge J source a Coulomb field. But a second way to solve it is to take just classically is to take AZ0 equals Q0, I guess I need an E squared Q0 over 4 pi Z minus Z0 times theta of V minus V0. And now, using the fact that dz bar of this is a delta function times 2 pi, and the other term, you take the dv, this turns into the delta function, then this will also solve it. Now, this will also give us, now let me make two, so in this is dressing it with a Coulomb field, and this I want to think of as dressing it with a cloud of soft photons. Not strictly zero momentum, because the Fourier transform of this has support away from zero momentum. It has a pole in it. And so these are two things that you can do. Now, So a funny thing about doing this is that this field, this Coulomb field, will go all the way up to scry minus plus, and then it won't obey the matching condition because there may be no other particles at this particular value of z on scry plus. So if we solve things in this way, we have another way of saying why the matrix element is zero. We don't obey the matching condition. So this is a nicer way of doing things. And moreover, notice that if we take nz, this is pure gauge away from v0. So this, what we're doing here is we're doing it's pure gauge away from a equals zero, but it's easy to see that nz, because of this theta function, is the difference between az plus and minus. So n minus z is just e squared q0 over 4 pi z minus z0, which is exactly the term coming from z0 in this term in the soft factor. Okay, so classically we could do this, and it would be good. What about quantum mechanically? So it automatically works that if we do this, we start out with the n zero, but we add these a's, then we get exactly. I may have lost some fives or twos. But we get exactly this.
So just to clarify, so these are two things that differ by a homogeneous solution, basically.
Yes.
Okay. And the energy is zero.
No, I don't think. No, the energy isn't zero.
It isn't zero.
No.
So these are
nz is non-zero, but I'm making a whole cloud. This is a whole cloud of radiative modes. It's not just if I take the Fourier transform of this,
yeah.
I get, maybe I should do that. I get that az zero of omega is e squared q zero over 4 pi omega z minus z0. So I'm giving a distribution of photons, a cloud of photons, with a pole at omega equals zero. And that, of course, is just because the Fourier transform of a step function is a pole.
So this is a new dressing with, you know, a higher energy than the Coulomb dress electron.
This is a new dressing with a higher energy than the Coulomb dress.
I think Coulomb's minimal, probably.
Yeah, I'm. I'm a little bit worried about the delta function here. That something, I would have to smear it a little bit.
And you also have to, if you're going to have different energy, higher energy, you have to introduce some scale.
Just hold on, David.
But I don't see the scale.
I haven't introduced a scale. I'm just going to consider a new set of states, a new set of classical solutions, in which I satisfy the constraints by surrounding these guys. If I try to scatter in this way, I get zero.
I'm just saying, the theory has no dimensional parameters.
Right. So how can I construct? Okay. I might have to make the energy finite, I might have to smear a little bit.
And that smearing will allow this arbitrary scale.
And that smearing will go an arbitrary scale. I'm not sure if I have to do that, but I might have to do
just
that.
Just on the basis of scale of there.
Yes.
It's either zero or infinity.
Yeah. We don't have any scale.
Okay.
So how can you get something that's not zero?
Oh, I'm going to get something that's not zero. You'll see in a second.
And the energy is not zero.
What I've done here is found a way to satisfy this condition.
The energy is not zero.
The energy is not zero, no. I have photons of all frequencies.
But the energy would be not zero. It must be a multiple of some thing which has dimensions of energy. And the theory has no dimensions of energy anyway, unless you introduce it.
That's right. But to avoid that, I may have to smear this over a point in the sphere. But let me say that such S matrix elements are also zero. That does not eliminate the infrared problem.
I didn't say it's an infrared regulator, but it's still scale. The usual treatment, like scale is introduced, which is operationally.
Right. I don't think I'm
not going to avoid.
All right. Tell me in a minute whether I've avoided it or not.
Well, you just said you have a state which is non-zero energy. And yet you can't...
Which has non-zero energy.
And that energy, which has dimensions of energy...
I don't know.
You haven't violated scale of energy. The dynamics of scale of energy.
Right. You're asking me an acausal question whose answer involves things I have not yet. All right. So what am I going to do with these states. So far I've only been having a classical discussion, but we can construct quantum states for which this guy viewed as an operator annihilates them because, see, ordinarily if you didn't excite any radio modes of non-zero frequency, you would say, I have this charge coming in, it must have this delta function in the Coulomb field which goes up to there. And now we're doing something different. At the classical level, we did something different. We dressed it with a cloud of radiative photons, and now we want to understand that quantum mechanically. And so what do we have quantum mechanically? Well, we have something like e to the I q0 integral d squared w log w minus z0 squared dz az plus dz bar az bar. And I want to take this in act on the initial state, one particle state, z0, and let's say take just n minus z equals 0 for simplicity. Okay, so this state, if this satisfies the constraints, taking this operator, this is a state in which if I pull f through, then I get, or pull a through, I get exactly this pole here. So nz on this state, if this state has nz equals 0, n minus z on this state, let me call this z 0, 0 dressed, n minus z on z 0, 0 dressed is equal to whatever factors q 0 over z minus z 0 on z0, 0 address. Okay? So this operator shifts nz.
Is this the state for an external charge? You're putting in a non-dynamic charge?
No. It's just, say, an incoming, I mean, I'm treating everything as massless, but I have an electron coming in from a point, it's going minus.
A classical electron?
No, quantum electron.
So this the space factor, this is some kind of Dirac dressing for the electron field?
Yes. But more precisely, okay, and here's the point. More precisely, these states have appeared before. Okay, they're sometimes called Chung states or Kibble states or Fedayeev-Kulis states. And it has been shown, so again, I'm not getting to someplace new, I'm getting to someplace that was arrived at in 1963, but from a different, I'm getting there from a different perspective. So let me just give a little background here, because I certainly wasn't familiar with this, and not too many people know about this. So let me give a little background. What's the usual story about infrared divergences in QED? The usual story about infrared divergences in QED is that you say, well, we cannot detect photons of arbitrarily low energy, so let's put in a cutoff, and let's not actually try to construct an S matrix. Let's just have inclusive cross-sections where we sum over the infrared sector. And then there are beautiful theorems showing that if you do that, the zero that we got from all these things individually be zero is canceled by an infinity, and appropriately defined infrared inclusive cross-sections are finite. That is perfectly fine if there's nothing wrong with that procedure if you want to compute scattering cross-sections at the LHC. Indeed, it's been tested to whatever, 16 decimal places. However, it is unsatisfactory if you, for a sort of mathematical quantum field theorist, in which the basic object is supposed to be the S matrix, to, you know, not have one because of infrared divergences. You would like a way of defining the S matrix. Moreover, there may be questions in which there are subtle orders of limits. For example, in this way of doing things, you can never see the memory effect, where the time scale of measuring the memory is taken to be a very long one. Now, then, this was discussed in the late 50s and the early 60s, culminating in a paper which I think it's fair to say most people now find it rather opaque, by Fadeyev and Kulish, in which they said that if you appropriately dress the outgoing states with photons, you can get a basis, an infrared finite basis of states, and this and what is it exactly that happens? Well, here's the thing that is giving a divergence. But now we take all the external lines and we put these clouds of photons surrounding every external line. And this is very explicitly what the cloud is. And now you have to add to this more diagrams. You have to add diagrams where soft photons are exchanged between external legs and the clouds that surround each particle. And Fadeyev and Kulish showed that the sums of these clouds are finite, and that this is a completely infrared finite basis for the S matrix. So what I've done here is reproduced in a different language. Fadeyev and Kulish, actually, this dressing here, Fadeyev and Kulish do something a little bit different. this AZ is evaluated at V0 W and W bar. And so what we're doing here is we have an outgoing electron, and we're dressing it with a cloud of soft photons. Frege and Kulish actually do something a little different. They have an outgoing electron, and then they also have an outgoing cloud of photons, which are not on top of the charged particle. But these two things differ by dressing the charged particle as it wants to be dressed by the constraint equation, differs from what Fadeev and Kulish did. And it's actually took us some time to take the Fadeev-Kulish result, which is all in momentum space, and write it as operators on the scribe. This situation, Fadeev-Kulish situation, and our situation differ only at sub-leading order in the low frequency expansion. And indeed, Fadeev-Kulish should say you can modify the dressing cloud by corrections of order omega, and you still get completely infrared finite S matrix. So the claim is, so I believe experts in quantum field theory in the audience could correct me, but I believe it is accepted that Fadeev and Kulish proved that the S matrix is in QED is finite in this basis, and there are no infrared divergences. So the conclusion then, and so we can just resort to their proof as applying to also to our construction, because the difference is subleading in the frequency expansion.
Their proof, I think, is just, it happens to be true only by our perturbation theory, correct?
Well, QED doesn't exist non-perturbatively, so.
That's might also be true, but the proof just is a proof of perturbation theory.
Yes. Yes. So here's the conclusion, that there aren't really infrared divergences in QED. That some things are zero because they're supposed to be zero. The vacuum changes whenever the vacuum in QED is infinitely degenerate, and whenever you scatter something, you always, unless it's a trivial scattering process, you always go from one vacuum to another. And so if you insist that the in and the out vacuum are the same, you get zero. That's supposed to happen. It's not a divergence. If you correctly account as this dressing factor here is doing for the fact that the vacuum must shift, the infrared divergences disappear. It would have been extremely inobvious to for us to have proven that from this formula, except for the fact that Fadeev and Kulish took care of it 50 years ago.
But you know, there's also a history of degenerate perturbation theory, which even non-relativistically, these issues are not. So the physical cure of Bloch and Neurzig, me and Nauberg, etc., didn't use all of this machinery. It wasn't necessary because of was more an application of degenerate perturbation theory. Therefore, I don't think it was ever suspicious that there didn't exist some state. In practice, even though these states, you know, summarize what's needed to make the S matrix out finite, it's not actually what you would ever do. The reason we're interested eventually in scattering differences is that they're measurable.
No, it is what you do.
No, I don't think so. I don't think you could actually measure these amplitudes. You could actually only use instruments with finite resolution. So you would have to still sum squares of these amplitudes.
But if you, for example, consider, I believe it to be the case, that if you, for example, create an electron-positron pair in electric field, it will come dressed with a cloud of photons that look like this, not this.
And how would you possibly make the properties of the cloud if you use a finite resolution?
Well, okay. Now, of course, there's limits what we can measure.
Not always.
But what do you mean, not always? There's always something like that. How can you can't just
that? That can be measured quite precisely.
Quite precisely. Okay. Now, one of the interesting things that also I haven't talked that much about the memory effect, but you might wonder, you know, the memory effect, it's about zero momentum, right? So, you know, you can't, you know, you'd think you'd need an antenna that was infinitely long or a detector that was, you know. But in fact, there are all kinds of proposals to measure the gravitational memory effect, which has to do with zero momentum gravitons. Now, how does that work? Well, the reason it works is that, yes, there's a pole at zero momentum, but the Fourier transform of a pole is a step function. And the step function goes from its bottom value to its top value in a finite amount of time. So these things at very low energy, these poles at low energy, in fact, can be measured, and there are proposals to measure them in a finite amount of time. So I think the fact that not only can this be measured, but there are proposals to measure it, and I think in QED it could also be done, that there is a dressing of this type accompanying, you know, they're looking, you know, for colliding black holes, or there's a proposal at LIGO to see this. So yes, it can be measured.
I don't mean that actual pole, but as you said, the difference between what you construct and what the Kulish constructed, it doesn't change. So the precise detail of this cloud.
Oh.
That I don't see how you could possibly.
Of course, but I do think that physical states are dressed in with roughly clouds in many real situations. They are roughly dressed with clouds of this type, and moreover, that the vacuum, the flat connection in the vacuum, does change in finite amounts of time in real-world scattering processes. So finally, also I wanted to say that going on to, again, this is just reproducing what but maybe with some new insight, something that Fedev and Kulish did. Something that we don't understand is how to construct an S matrix in non-abelian gauge theory. And I think that the same lesson should be true, that the reason there are infrared divergences in non-abelian gauge theory is that we presume in every calculation that the vacuum doesn't change, and we can certainly easily derive a classical selection rule here relating the changes in the flat non-abelian connection on the sphere to the to the flux of colored of the color flux through gluon flux through past and future null infinity, and it's not perhaps so hard to construct at null infinity states in which the constraints are satisfied, the non-abelian constraints are satisfied, and so those would be candidates for states in which, in the non-abelian gauge theory, in which infrared divergences don't exist.
I mean, your non-abelian gauge theory is by far the worst, the hardest possible case. Not only do you...
It was a challenge. It was a challenge to the audience.
So let me just warn the audience. This is by far the most difficult case since the gluons, the massless particles themselves are charged. And the charge is non-vanishing at zero. Gravity is simple compared to non-abelian gauge theory, since the energy is the charge and it vanishes for soft graviton. Soft gravitons don't emit soft gravitons, but then non-vanishing amplitude. And soft gluons in the non-abelian gauge theory emit soft gluons.
Right.
In fact,
but now I think we have a more geometric way.
Understood originally, before we understood confinement better. The thought was that this was so impossible that that alone would prevent you from a physical theory from ever existing in the Coulomb case. Now, understanding a confinement has pushed that aside. You know, we don't have to worry about that in QCD. If I don't have a Coulomb case, in fact, it sounds like it's certainly not infinite.
In fact, for a case of a single gluon coming out, exactly this dressing.
Yeah, but that's, you know, sure. The lowest order perturbation theory, gluons don't emit gluons because the coupling is small. But once they start emitting them, unless you have a confinement theory where the basis in the Hilbert space of neutral space.
So are you saying there is no S matrix in N equals 4 Young-Mills theory? There can't be?
Conceivably, there could be, but it's hard to imagine. And it's certainly, furthermore, not only is it, okay. There's another reason aside from the complication of soft particles having non-vanishing charges.
But if there's no S matrix in non-abelian gauge theory, half this room has been wasting their last decade.
There's no good answer even in the level of Wolf-Hertz
theory. I agree with you, David, and that's exactly why.
Incredibly harder than QED or gravity.
That's exactly why I think this is interesting, because I think we have a new geometric picture that might or might not be useful in addressing this
problem. By the way, of course, is that in the soft regime is exactly where you want to put the strong coupling issues and not against them.
Yes.
Just characteristics. And QED, even though you said, well, it doesn't exist as a theory, so I don't worry about the proofs not just being perturbative.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you could put in ultraviolet regulator and it would have nothing to do with this issue. But in non-abelian gauge theories in this regime of Kaplan-Meta, you're in a strong coupling regime of perturbative constructions of this type of coupling universe. But
it's certainly a hard problem.
If you've made any progress, that would be fascinating. But you're approaching the perturbative.
Well, no, you see, I'm working at Scry, and for example, you know, a lot of at Scry perturbation theory is good, and it is sort of always good in a sense because the fields have become infinitely weak.
Remember, that's where. States combined to give.
Well, for example, this commutator is still.
Not if you have confinement.
Oh, this is not relevant to a theory with confinement.
Yeah, what if the sine of the beta function is here? What if you have the other side of the beta function?
Yeah. Well, what theory are we talking about?
Put in enough flavors and colors. So.
Right, this is not, I'm assuming that there are unconfined gluons, otherwise there's no soft there. So, I mean, really thinking about n equals 4.
Right.
Right.
You have massless charged particles here, right?
Yes.
I think the mass, isn't massless charged particles similar to QCD?
No.
You have hard emission if you have massless charged
Well,
an electron emits a photon with an amplitude that doesn't go to zero with zero momentum.
It never goes to zero with zero momentum. The photon emits. The electron emits a photon with final gravitons. You don't emit gravitons. Electrons emit photons. The thing is, photons don't.
They can turn to electron-positron pairs.
Yeah, but that's a two-body thing. It's not the
same thing.
In any case, he didn't really worry about the photon pairs. I mean, the electron-positron pairs. It's just about the photon.
Well, I certainly agree it's a hard problem.
Can I just ask a simple question about QED? Have you tried looking at the two-point function of your addressed electrons? Because usually you can calculate this. I mean, there's an infrared form that's sort of well-known. It goes back to Avogadro.
I think the answer is yes. I'll talk about this at my... You mean the soft... part of the
soft part of the electron propagator, of the electron Green's function.
Yeah, so there's something very nice that happens there, which is, this is, I'll talk about it a little, we have a paper coming out, but I'll talk about it a little bit. So, there's something called the soft factorization theorem in QED, which says that any scattering amplitude can be written, you put in some IR dividing line, and any scattering amplitude can be written as a hard part times a soft part, where the soft part contains all the soft and collinear poles. So I mentioned briefly this current algebra. So it turns out that there are more things to tell you about the current algebra than what I said. But what we showed is that this, and the soft part is tree level exact, and it's known, and it's some formula with Cauchy's and whatever it's on. That formula is exactly the formula. So there's another example of this, which is if you do two-dimensional conformal field theory on a sphere, where you have a U1 current algebra, you can write every operator as a sort of stripped operator, in which you strip off the current algebra piece, and then every correlation function, correlation functions in 2D CFTs with current algebras also factorize into what's called the parafermion piece, which is the correlation functions of the stripped operators, and then the current algebra correlator. So we've shown that that current algebra correlator is exactly the soft part of the QED S matrix. And the level of the current algebra is the what's called the cusp anomalous dimension. So there's a very kind of detailed agreement that works out there.
So this some piece in the sublimit differs in your case the original. So is there any preferred or interesting?
The subleading piece.
Yeah.
And the soft serum.
Yeah. Well, you said that they differ.
No, I think that, you know, Fadeyev, Kulish, I would say Fadeyev and Kulish write down a whole, they have a whole function. And they don't have any natural way to fix that function.
But you get a definite.
Well, I can always take this state and add more free photons to it, free incoming photons to it. So, but there's a rather natural expression which respects, I guess here's a point, right? If you have a massless particle coming out, it preserves some symmetry, boosts along the trajectory of the particle and rotations around it. And the Fadeyev-Kulish construction doesn't respect that symmetry. And by pinning down the symmetries a little more, you get a more unique state.
Are there any more questions? If not, thanks, Andy.